Okay, what's up, drinking comrades, and welcome back to another episode of the Beverage Gate podcast dedicated to the discussion surrounding beverages with an Asian perspective. I'm your resident host, Sean Oh, co-founder of the Beverage Click Academy, with our HQ in Singapore. Now, this episode takes us to the trending private members club, 67 Pall Mall. But before we enter our interview, this month's flashcard question is actually spirits related, and the answer will be revealed towards the end of the episode, like always. Right. So the question is, pot stills are commonly made from what kind of metal? Okay, pot stills are most commonly made in with what kind of metal? Now, remember to stay tuned for the answer at the end of the podcast. And let's start our interview proper. So we are kind of in for a treat today with this month's featured guest, Mr. Richard Hemming, MW on our show. Now, he's the head of wine Asia for 67 Pall Mall. And as his post nominal suggests, well, he's a master of wine. Currently, at the time of this recording, there are only 419 master of wines based in 30 countries all around the world with that credential. And that credential is also widely seen as the pinnacle of wine accolades. So, hey, Richard, thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
It's good seeing you again. It's kind of like deja vu because this is like the second time coming. We've been doing this. We did this previously with 67 TV.
Yes, exactly. That was before the club opened. So we actually filmed just over there.
Yes.
At the top of Ion.
Uh-huh.
And we were discussing how to describe wine with Asian flavors, I believe.
Yes, good memory. And that particular episode, well, was it the first time you trying, was it jackfruit?
Yeah, exactly. And I quite like jackfruit, you know.
Uh-huh.
Definitely more than durian. I'd say my durian tolerance is still very low.
Okay. Have you tried it again after that?
Yeah, actually. Uh-huh. I always try and taste different flavors whenever I can, especially if it's something I'm not familiar with, because, you know, it's just good for your professional experience to be able to refer to different flavors.
Yeah, I agree. Well, again, thank you for being on the show today. And, you know, considering you're a master of wine, I figured that it would be good for you to provide some advice for aspiring master of wines like myself, you know, for listeners who are also aspiring to take on that route. So perhaps you could share a little bit more about your wine journey and your current capacity with 67 Pall Mall. Maybe we'll start with how you started with your wine journey.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have any understanding of wine until I took a job with a retailer in the UK. So I went to university in Leeds and I saw a job advertised in the student newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
For a chain called Majestic Wine, who had a reputation at the time for being the best training ground for wine professionals. I didn't realize that. All I saw was job in wine shop and thought, you know, I think I could probably do that. It promised to give you quick promotion. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was kind of curious about wine, but I seriously had absolutely no knowledge at all. The wine that I drank at the time, because I was a student, was a Spanish red from the corner shop, and you could get two bottles for £5. So like $9.
Was it like a Rioja or?
No, not even close. It was like the stuff that gets left over from the end of the Spanish wine production, just like rolled into one. I mean, it was really poor quality in retrospect, but that's all I saw wine as. It was just like cheap, easy drinking. I had no idea. When I started with Majestic, I was taught WSET. Mm-hmm. Classes. I stayed with them for 6 years. And by the end of it, I had passed the diploma. I was managing one of the busier shops in London. And I was hooked. I was really interested in wine. I had a professional foundation to develop my career. So that's how I got started. And then if I go on to what led me to the MW, after I left Majestic, I started working as a freelancer in communication. So I was writing for Jancis Robinson's website. I was tutoring. I was hosting masterclasses. And some of my colleagues at the time, and I would have been around 30, 31 years old, some of my colleagues were talking about taking the Master of Wine, and I had never even considered it. But I realized that if I wanted to be taken seriously in a freelance career, then I had to be at the highest level I could achieve.
Yeah.
So I enrolled thinking, at the very least, this will be an interesting
journey.
And actually, to be fair, one of the reasons why I wanted to enroll in the course was I was writing for Jancis, as I said. I needed to have some kind of long topic, a kind of project that I could write about every month. So I started a diary of being a Master of Wine student. And that lasted for 7 years in the end, because it took me that long to pass. But that was a really useful way for me to record my experiences and also to keep myself motivated, because I knew that I had to keep this article every month describing what was doing, describing my progress.
Right.
And so in the end, in 2015, I passed the Master of Wine. And there's a lot more to say about that, but that's the outline.
Oh, wow. Well, that's quite a journey. I mean, and it took you 7 years, was it?
Yeah, it is possible in theory to pass in 3 years. Most candidates take at least four, and it's not unusual to take five, six, seven, or even longer.
Yeah, yeah. Any idea what's the current record?
Well, I mean, there's now a system in place to prevent people from taking too long, because what we found is that some candidates just would end up lost in the system, you know, and for whatever reason, they weren't passing. And really, it's kinder to tell people like that, you really should probably take a step back, figure out what's going wrong. But I know that there were people who had been trying for 10 years.
Yeah. Back then, when you were in the system, was the diploma a requirement?
Not a requirement. And in fact, strictly speaking, still not a requirement.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We would accept the equivalent. So it's quite usual, for example, for European winemakers who've been to like Bordeaux or Montpellier or Geisenheim to have a 3-year winemaking degree, but no diploma. In fact, probably no WSET at all.
Huh.
And we wouldn't decline those people just because they hadn't done WSET. They would have to prove that they did have the requisite knowledge level.
Yeah.
But it's not an absolute requirement. Having said that, it is definitely the best preparation.
Right. Okay. Yeah, because I'm a diploma graduate, and I had a couple of my course mates, they weren't really bumped out from the program, from MW program, but they were told to at least get a diploma first before ever coming back to attempt again. So I always had this impression that, you know, you need a diploma. Well, that was one reason why I decided to take it. I'm just, you know, again, aspiring to be like you. You know, I want to grow up and just be like you. What kind of attributes do you think innately as a person, or, you know, as a wine student, that you need to be, you know, to achieve a Master of Wine degree?
Well, I would say two things for that. The first is, you do not need a natural aptitude for tasting. I don't think Masters of Wine have a particular talent or any kind of ingrained skill or ability to taste. I think it is all 100% learned. And often the assumption is that we must be super tasters or something like that. Absolutely not. The other part of it really is that I think there is only one quality that is required, and that is a real genuine desire to get the qualification to become a Master of Wine. And people often fail, unfortunately, I think, because they either don't quite have that motivation, or life gets in the way. And that's not their fault. You know, people have jobs, they have families.
Yeah.
It does require a huge amount of dedication. And if you're not able to give that time, then it's very difficult to pass.
Did you make any kind of sacrifices like that during your studies? I figured you probably made many, but you know, anything significant?
Well, I mean, I was fortunate at the time. I was single and I had no mortgage and no kids. And I was self-employed, so I could fit study in around my work. And also my job, you know, I was writing and communicating. A lot of my job involved going and tasting. So I was tasting hundreds of wines a month, not having to pay for it. So I was very fortunate. So I don't feel like I did make any sacrifices. But in the way that it becomes this sort of all-consuming mindset, I know that I will have turned down certain opportunities that otherwise I might have taken, you know, social opportunities, I mean, you know. So for me, it was a minor thing. And another thing that I like to try and get across, especially to candidates when they start, because they think they have to abandon everything else in order to study. And I like to ask them, you know, what TV show are you watching and what movies do you like and what books are you reading? Because it's otherwise it just becomes this echo chamber. And you have to keep up your life outside the MW at the same time, just to keep your sanity.
Really? I thought I would have to give up my favorite TV show if I, you know, even embark on that, on this journey. Okay, well, that's quite, well, I think that's good advice from a master of wine. Now, let's talk a little bit more about your current capacity here as a head of wine for 67 Palmar Asia. So what do you actually do here?
So I have duties to three departments, really. The wine team, which includes the seller team and the sommelier team. That is everything that involves wine, from the ordering to the receival and the storing and the serving and the wine tower, where we keep a lot of our wine to make sure that everything is stocked properly, that we have the right range, everything wine related. However, my head sommelier and my cellar master are really doing most of the work there, so they make it easy for me. So I work with them, I oversee them, but really they are doing the majority of the work there with their teams. I also work with the events team. That's a significant part of the job, because we have a brilliant events team, but they don't necessarily have top level wine expertise. So when we're trying to arrange events that involve very demanding wine requirements, you know, it might be wines that need to be decanted or served at a certain temperature and served in the correct glassware and all that kind of thing, I would advise them on that. And then I work with the marketing team as well. And it's for the same reason. Marketing team are great, but they don't necessarily have the wine knowledge that might be necessary. So I feed into those departments.
I see. And well, just jumping a gun here, but in terms of events, 67 Palmar would also be running, besides some wine, I assume, other kind of drinks events?
Yeah. We have started a few spirits events. We've done a rum event and we're planning a cognac event. And because whiskey is such a big deal, we will definitely be doing some whiskey tastings. We are open to anything, really. We have done cocktail events in London. We have done sake events in London. So anything really that's related to the world of drinks is an option. However, we always say that wine is the center of what we do, and that will always be the majority of what we offer.
Yeah, so I would assume that the reception for wine would be a lot better, I suppose.
Yeah, you know, members join because we have got a wine proposition that we would say is not really rivaled quite to the level that we can deliver it. You know, there are other great wine bars and wine clubs in Singapore and around the world, and we love those places too, and we work closely with them, and we don't feel like we're their competition, but we really think that there's nowhere else where you can get the glassware, the expertise, the atmosphere, all in one place. And that's what we try and deliver. And so that's why wine is always going to be the priority.
Yeah, well, I can affirm that because I'm a member here as well. So, and you know what actually got me to being a member was when I visited the London Club, and I thought it was magnificent. It was great. So, but clearly there is slight variances, you know, between the London one and the Singapore one. Is there any unique differences that you know of, or any selling points?
Well, in terms of the core proposition, it's the same, and that's actually quite important. You know, we have 5,000 wines by the bottle, 1,000 of those available by the glass. We have a full all-day dining menu. We have Xalto glassware throughout. Those are the things that people join £67 Mal for. On top of that, and this is a really important factor, our wine prices are around half what you would expect us to pay in a restaurant. So that's the core thing, and that will always be the core part of every club around the world. Here in Singapore, we have a much bigger spirits selection available. So we have an additional floor, which is dedicated to spirits. You can get wine there too, of course, because we'll always allow that. But we have a selection of around 300 whiskies, I think, as well as rums, cognacs, and gins, etc. Cocktails available as well. You're aware that we have a terrace upstairs, mm-hmm. where it's al fresco dining, so a bit more casual. The London Club doesn't have that. We're also extending that. So we've now got what we call a garden bar. Which is like a tiki bar style. So much, much more casual. There'll be a keg of beer. Again, wine will be available, but this is much more like a sort of casual drop-in style place. And because it's al fresco and it's got these amazing views, that's something that the London Club doesn't have. In terms of the interior design, it's very similar. But for example, we consulted a feng shui master throughout the building of the club. So a lot of the items that you see around the club have been placed there and must never be moved.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so those sorts of things. Like, we really wanted to work in the culture of Singapore, not least because we think it's the right thing to do, but also because the Shaw family, who are our landlords, it's important to them as well.
Right. And that spirits corner is called the Naughty Corner.
Naughty Corner, yeah. That's a name that did come from London. In the London Club, there is literally a corner of small
naughty
room.
People.
No. Well, we call them naughty because they're in a wine club, but they're drinking spirits. So that was really where it came from. And the decor of that particular corner, in keeping with the naughty theme, had some very tasteful nude pictures on the wall, which we haven't repeated here, I must add. But yeah, it was a sort of little bit playful. And the name Naughty Corner just stuck. So we've called it that here as well.
Yeah. Well, is there any differences in terms of management philosophy? I mean, with the team here, or, you know, clearly it's in the London Club, it's managed by a different set of people. So is there any philosophy that you've inculcated, you know, to the people on the ground?
Well, it all comes from the founder and the CEO. So Grant Ashton came up with the whole idea for the club, and he has driven the culture of the club from the very first day, and he still is heavily involved. Everything comes from that philosophy, and because he sort of thinks of himself as the first member, he will often give us instructions, tasks that may not make perfect business sense, but are the best thing to do for our members from a member's point of view. In terms of how that works in the culture of the staff, we would like to think that everybody here understands the interest of wine. You know, whether they are a sommelier pouring for people all day, or whether they're in the kitchen, you know, turning out tart flambé. We would hope that they understand that there is this unifying reason why we're all here. And that's something that 67 has got that a lot of other clubs don't. They don't have a single reason to exist. So is there any difference in the staff culture? I never worked in the London club, so I can't really answer for that. I was a member there. From my observations, I would say no. I think the fact that it's similar, if not identical, is actually really important.
Oh, okay. So there's some form of uniformity across board. Well, it's good to, you know, to maintain standards, I assume. Talking about the team here, are there any kind of credentials that you know, you are looking for, or you know, your boss is looking for, that would welcome these people, you know, to the wine team?
In the sommelier team, when they are customer facing and handling wine, you know, we require at least WSET level 2, and that would only get you in as a junior sommelier.
I see.
And when we support people to take WSET level 3 and diploma, and you know, we would support them right up to MS and or MW. For the rest of the team, there's no wine requirement. The really important thing is personality, because that's the only thing you can't teach. So if you have somebody that is open-minded and helpful and friendly, that will inform how they work, how they interact with members. They might be the most knowledgeable, intelligent person in the world, but if they don't come across as
hospitable,
exactly, yeah, then it wouldn't work out.
I see. Well, that's good to know. So the prerequisite is still being service at the end of the day.
Yeah, of course. You know, we are a members club. We're not a standard restaurant where you might only come in once a year. We want members to come in regularly. We have some members who are coming in 3, 4, 5 times a week, and we want to get to know them. We want them to know us. We want them to be, you know, part of the club. And that is, you know, the way to do that is to make them feel welcome, to understand them, to recognize them, to know their names, to know their interests. Mm-hmm. And so the, you know, having the staff to do that is obviously vital.
Right. So in that case, if, and back to credentials again, if they were to, you know, upgrade themselves from a level 2 to a level 3, or even a level 3 to a diploma, would that garner promotion?
I mean, not immediately.
Yeah.
But yes, it's an important part of it. We for example, we ran the Court of Master Sommelier courses here. And the members of the team who took those exams, whether it was the advanced or the introductory, are now on a progression to become promoted. And to have opportunities to take further exams so that they can further get promotion.
Mm-hmm.
And so we definitely encourage staff to take that journey.
Yeah, well, congratulations on running that the exam, because the last time I remembered that exam being run was like easily at least 10 years ago, because I was part of that batch.
Right.
And we were the only, it was the only one run in Singapore.
Yeah.
So it was... Well, it's good memories, and I'm glad that more and more people are actually getting that credential. Talking about the wine list, but well, clearly here, you know, there's a really extensive wine list, and I love the fact that you could get it at a 25 mil pour, 75 mil pour, even 150 mil pour. So, how is the inventory usually managed, you know, behind the scenes?
It's quite interesting that a lot of it is actually just done on feel. You would think that we had an incredibly sophisticated database. And we do have that, and we can pull those numbers out. But when you're dealing with 5,000 wines, there are two ways of doing it. One is the SOMs give us feedback. So if we have 30 white burgundies on by the glass, that's actually not really enough. Now, for most places, that would be impossible to manage.
Yeah.
Because they're looking at the list and they're like, okay, you've got 3 or 4 Pellinis, you've got 3 or 4 Meursaults, you've got 5 Chablis, but where's your Sainte-Aubin? So we need to have everything represented. We need to have everything from the Mâconnais, from Côte Chalonnaise, Côte d'Or, and Chablis. Everything has to be there. And ideally, we want to have it several different vintages, several different crew levels, top-end producers, really affordable, larger producers. Because that's what people are coming here for. So it's somewhat done on feel. You can't look at it as a number. Like if I told you, oh, we have 30 white burgundies on by the glass, you'd think, okay, well, that's enough. But what you've actually got to do is analyze it and be like, oh, wait, we don't have a Saint-Aubin or we don't have a Puy-Fuisé, so we need to get some. Our stock holding is very low, so we might only have 6 bottles or even less. And so things tend to turn over quickly. I was just looking at our sparkling wine list today and saw that we've sold through loads of Californian sparkling, so I need to restock that. We've got loads and loads of champagne, but you can always find a gap. Like, where's the Blanc de Noir vintage? We don't have one. So, okay, go and find one. There's actually a really good one from the UK that we're
having. Really?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a lot done on feel. And then on the other hand, you know, we do have quite sophisticated systems. We have a bespoke system that runs our iPad and can tell us a lot about what's selling, what stock levels we have, the price we bought it at last, current market price, what's the difference, all those sorts of things. And that's something that we're going to be working on more in future. It's part of the role that we were talking about before we started recording, to have people that are dedicated to looking at that sort of data more in depth.
I see. So technology does play a huge part here.
Yeah, I mean, the iPad wine list is vital. Without that, you can't have a paper wine list of 5,000 wines. Well, you can in theory, but maintaining it would just be a nightmare.
Yeah.
The other thing about technology is that Coravan makes this club possible. You know, all of our wine is served through Coravan and by the glass. And it's not absolutely flawless, but it is 99% in terms of the serving quality. And without that, again, it would be very difficult to manage.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, just hunting for a bottle of wine would probably take you like 45 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, fulfillment time is a serious challenge. Mm-hmm. We have a storage unit in this building, but on the second floor. We're currently on the 27th floor. That storage unit has 80,000 bottles, or capacity for 80,000 bottles.
Wow.
And if you order something that happens to be down there, it sets off a chain reaction of events that can take 10, maybe 15 minutes to fulfill. Mm-hmm. A lot of that time relies on whether the lifts are working properly, which isn't always the case. And so we have to explain to members, listen, we've got this wine. It's going to take us a while. You know, we're going to have to bring it up, and then we'll prepare it and serve it properly. So in the meantime, would you like a glass of English Blanc de Noir?
Which brand is that? Is it just
Roebuck. Do you know Roebuck?
Roebuck.
It's bought in by Joey Maiton at Fermented.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, good to know. Yeah. Well, I'd love to try it one day. So the wine list does get quite a bit of refresh, judging from what you say.
Mm.
Mm. Well, since you mentioned about Joey, I'm just curious, how or what would a distributor do, you know, or what elements does a brand bring for you to, you know, to take attention towards it?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because the worst kind of email I get is a sort of out of the blue, we have a great selection of wines, would you like to buy some? because it's meaningless. Like, I can find great selections of wines from anybody. If they have a really particular angle, that helps. So I had a tasting with a very small importer who were bringing in wine from Georgia, but also Moldova and Romania. Now, those two in particular were interesting, because we like to have as many countries on the wine list as we can.
Mm-hmm.
We know they're not going to sell high volumes, but that was enough to make me interested. So we bought a small selection from that importer. Otherwise, we just keep our eyes open for what's out there. You know, like every industry, it's all built on relationships. And the suppliers and importers who were supportive of us right from the very beginning, when nobody knew who we were and we were delayed with COVID and there were all these uncertainties, those suppliers who were kind of loyal and helpful to us then, you know, obviously we're kind of in their favor, and we like to give them business as well.
Yeah,
that's, some of them are very big suppliers and some of them are really small. Yeah. But you know, they bring in good stuff and our members drink it. So
I mean, it's very refreshing to hear from you, you know, that because usually when we post that question, it's usually a unique selling point from the brand or distributor. But the fact that you've been quite candid about the fact that they need to be, I mean, it's all about relationship. Yeah. We are in Asia after all.
Mm.
So it's quite, it's good to hear, you know, that we focus on something that's a little bit more intangible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I appreciate that. More about the wine list though. So clearly this is a place of wine offerings, but do you think, and you probably already answered part of it, do you think spirits and sake has a place?
Yes, but we have to decide what our role will be. Like, we're never going to be the old alliance, right? This great whiskey place with all these incredible bottlings. We can't be that. We don't want to be that. We think they're great at doing that. So where are we going to sit? Are we going to be a very small but very focused selection? Are we going to be just premium and top end? I think the answer to that is we are figuring it out as we go. And for spirits, anyway. For sake, we only have one on the list. And we don't have any sake specialists on the team. So if we were to develop that, we would need to make sure it was supported properly. Mm. And, you know, that's something that would require quite a bit of investment and so would be something we'd consider later. Ultimately, we will respond to our members. If our members say to us, where's all the sake, then we will bring that in. We know that they like spirits. And in fact, the fact that we have a kind of dedicated spirits area comes from their feedback. We were told constantly, listen, you're in Asia, whiskey's such a big deal, you can't just have a sort of afterthought, it has to be a decent part of the club. So that's where that came from, and so we will keep on responding to what our members ask for.
Good. Well, hopefully our listeners will give more feedback, you know, so that you can have a bigger repertoire in your club. You know, with the expansion outside of UK into Asia, is there any plans for 67 Pall Mall to be anywhere else?
Yes, we are looking actively in Mumbai.
Ah.
We have been speaking to people in Tokyo. We would love to be in Melbourne and Sydney, but that is much more speculative right now. Longer term, we would love to be in Shanghai, maybe Shenzhen, but at the moment that's not really feasible because they're struggling a bit still with COVID regulations.
Yeah.
Elsewhere in the world, we would love to be in North America, probably San Francisco. We've got our eye on quite a few places in mainland Europe. Berlin would be one of the key cities. But we are also opening, and these are confirmed, we are opening two clubs in France next year, one in Beaune and one in Bordeaux.
Nice.
And those are much smaller scale, but obviously they are strategically important because they're right in the center of the two most important.
Exactly. And members will be able to visit them freely, I suppose.
Exactly. Membership is reciprocal. So any London member or any Singapore member can go to any of the clubs. Plus, we have the club in Verbier, Switzerland, which, you know, is a smaller scale club as well, but, you know, caters to our members who go skiing anyway, and therefore hopefully will frequent the club.
Okay, well, I think that's it's quite informative, and I'm glad to be a member of the club. You know, I hope to be back real soon. I think with that, we're going to wrap up today's episode. Again, thank you for your time. And before we wrap up, you know, just a quick shout out to our listeners that the schedules for the courses are all up on the website. So please do check it out. It runs monthly. And lastly, before we end the podcast episode, the answer to the spirits flashcard question.
Can I guess?
Yes, please.
See if I can remember this from my WSET level 4 when you had to do spirits as well. Copper.
Copper, exactly. Thank you very much. And well, that was an easy one. But thank you for that. And you know, finally, if you would like to hear more drinks content, please do like and subscribe to the channel. I look forward to seeing all of you, maybe Richard again, sometime in the future. And remember, a drink always tastes better when a company clicks. Cheers.
Thank you.